Welcome back to the program. There's a current fad in the diet world known as the paleo diet. The idea is that we should eat what Paleolithic men ate in order to be protected from the scourges of modern processed food. While hearkening back to our hunter-gatherer ancestors may be good nutrition, it's not necessarily good thinking. My guest, Harvard cognitive neuroscientist and philosopher Joshua Green, argues that some of our biggest problems arise from our habit of using Paleolithic moral thinking to deal with the problems of 21st century life. Joshua Green is the John and Ruth Hazel Associate Professor of the Social Sciences Department of Psychology at Harvard University, and it is my pleasure to welcome Joshua Green to the program today to talk about his new book, Moral Tribes, Emotion, Reason, and the Gap Between Us and Them. Joshua Green, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. One of the central ideas that you talk about in the book is the idea that there are two kinds of moral problems that we face in the world today, and two kinds of moral thinking with which we address them, and they don't always line up in the proper way.
Right. So the idea is that the basic cooperation problem, the problem that we have evolved to solve, is the problem of getting a bunch of individuals to cooperate in a group, to care not just about themselves, but to care about others. So basically, it's turning a bunch of separate me's into an us. And we're very good at that. That's what we have lots of good gut reactions that help us do this. So we empathize with other people. We feel guilty if we don't take care of the people in our personal world. We feel anger and contempt towards people who don't do what they're supposed to do. We've got a lot of moral machinery in our brains designed by evolution and designed by cultural experience that enables us to get along well in groups, in tribes, essentially. But the modern world is a different kind of problem. So every tribe, every moral group has its own terms of cooperation, and some may be more individualistic, some may be more collectivist, some may have a strong code of honor. If someone insults you, you have to go after them. Others may emphasize harmony. And different groups rally around what I call different proper nouns, so different religious leaders, religious ideas, gods, traditions. And so what you have in the modern world is many different moral tribes that are all cooperative in some sense, but that cooperate on these different terms. And then when we converge in the modern world, we have a very hard time getting along, or at least, you know, relatively speaking, because we have gut reactions that tell us what's right and wrong, but those gut reactions differ. And so this brings us to the second thing that you said, which is that we have two different ways of moral thinking. And my analogy for this is it's like a digital SLR camera. So you've got your point-and-shoot settings. You can put your camera in landscape mode or portrait mode, and that's great. It's point-and-shoot. It's very efficient. You could also put your camera in manual mode, which is very flexible but not very efficient. You can do anything with it, but you have to know what you're doing. It takes a little time, and you might make a mistake. And the human brain has the same basic design. Our automatic settings are our gut reactions, and they give us pretty good advice about getting along in everyday life. And then our capacity for deliberate, explicit, abstract reasoning is our manual mode, which allows us to deal with situations that our gut reactions are not necessarily prepared for. And I think the problem in the modern world is that we've got the wrong kind of thinking for the kinds of problems that divide us. So our gut reactions are very good at having us get along in groups with personal relationships, or where if we share a common religion, let's say, with other people. But what we do in the modern world is we take our tribal gut reactions and try to use them to solve problems like our disagreements over abortion or the Affordable Care Act or how we should respond to the problems in the Middle East or whatever it is. And because we have different gut reactions coming from our different tribes, that doesn't work so well. And so the natural solution then is to shift into manual mode. But it's not always clear what exactly that means.
Except even when we go into that manual mode, to that slower way of thinking, and we think that we're bringing logic and facts to the table, that oftentimes those facts are a part of the confirmation bias that we have, and
right,
we marshal only those facts that support what our gut reaction is.
Right. So that's exactly right. And this is why I said it's tricky to know what it means to be in manual mode. What we tend to do with our moral reasoning is just try to come up with rationalizations or justifications for what our gut reactions, for what our automatic settings are telling us. So most of the time, our what looks like explicit reasoning, people giving rational justifications for what they think, it's really just rationalizing our feelings. And so then the question is, how do we move beyond that? So take the case of abortion. Different groups have very strong feelings about abortion. Some people think it's murder. Other people think it's a reasonable choice for someone to make, depending on their situation. And the way we talk about this is we talk about it in terms of rights. So the people on the left say a woman has a right to choose. And the people on the right say a fetus has a right to life. And when you say, you know, you appeal to these abstract ideals of rights, this all sounds very rational and reasonable. But I think an evidence suggests that a lot of what's really going on here is we have a gut feeling about this, and then we just use talk of rights to make our gut feeling sound like an abstract, rational, objective thing, as opposed to just the feeling that we have. An alternative approach is to say, well, look, instead of trying to figure out rights, which is very difficult, let's try to instead focus on the practical consequences, let's say, of having abortion be legal or having abortion be illegal. And my view, backed up, I hope, I think, by a lot of evidence, is that that's more likely to bring us together than simply pounding our fists and making claims about rights that are very hard to justify. And I should explain a bit about why I think those claims are so hard to justify. So I'm pro-choice about abortion, but I actually think that it's surprisingly hard to give a coherent pro-choice argument. So, for example, people who are pro-choice will say a woman has a right to choose, but they don't think that a woman has a right to choose at 9 months of pregnancy. So the real question is, what happens between month one and month nine? And there are things that happen. According to Roe v. Wade, the sort of prevailing standard is the fetus viable outside the womb? But that doesn't seem to be what people really care about. For example, if you had a woman who had a fetus at 9 months with a rare condition such that the fetus couldn't breathe outside the womb now, but in a few days that will resolve and then the child will be born and everything will be fine, you wouldn't say that 9-month-old fetus could be aborted simply because at the moment it's not viable outside the womb. And we could appeal to other things like, does the fetus feel pain or does it have some kind of consciousness? But you could say the same thing about a lot of animals that we eat or that we allow others to eat as a matter of personal choice, that they feel pain or they have some kind of consciousness. This is not to say that you can't develop a coherent theory of the right to choose, but it's much harder than just saying, I believe in a woman's right to choose. And this is what we tend to do on the left, and on the right, similar kinds of fist pounding about a fetus's right to life. And so the alternative, as I said, is to think instead not about these abstract rights, but in terms of just what are the practical consequences of having this law versus having that law.
And to what extent does the debate between a utilitarian point of view and a moral point of view, to what extent did they come into conflict in trying to make these choices?
So I would actually say that a utilitarian point of view is a moral point of view. But the difference is that it's a more detached, abstract kind of point of view. That instead of following the gut feelings that we use for everyday morality, which are the ones that really feel moral, you're essentially taking the moral problems of the world and turning them over to a general reasoning system that's not necessarily specifically about morality. But of course, in my opinion, reasoning by itself can't solve the problem. It needs some kind of basic value premises. And the basic premises of what I call deep pragmatism, which is really, I think, the right way to think about this philosophy that goes back 200 years, utilitarianism, is it's really two things. It's combining first the golden rule, the idea that everybody's interests ultimately count the same. No one's inherently more important than anybody else. And then the more controversial part, the idea that behind all of the things that we value, or maybe most of the things that we value, is the quality of human experience. So if you ask yourself, well, why did you go to work today? Well, I enjoy it. Well, why else? Well, I need to earn money. Well, why do you need to earn money? Well, I have to pay the rent. Well, why do you need to pay the rent? Well, I need some place to sleep. Why don't you want to sleep outside? Well, it's cold, right? And it ultimately comes down to the quality of your experience or somebody else's experience. That's what we really care about. And so the original utilitarian philosophers, Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill, took this idea and said, you know what, what would really make sense in the modern world is to just try to maximize our happiness impartially, to reduce our suffering impartially. And with that idea, they made, I think, an enormous amount of moral progress. So they were among the first opponents of slavery. They were among the first proponents of free markets and free speech, and so on down the line. Many of the things that we just take for granted as being part of a modern civilized society were things that they fought for against the gut reactions of their day.
How does that run into the idea of this debate between collective interest and the collective and the commons and individual freedom and individual rights?
Right. So I think, you know, our gut reactions don't necessarily promote the greater good. So take for example our attitudes about taxes. A lot of people feel that this is my money, and if the government wants to take my money, that they are violating my rights in some way. Well, you know, where does that right come from? The Senator Elizabeth Warren, I think, did a wonderful job of sort of challenging that view in her famous YouTube speech that went viral a couple of years ago, where she said, look, if you built a factory and you built a business and it was a wonderful thing and you did a great job and you earned a lot of money, that's wonderful. But don't forget that others have contributed to your success, that you moved your goods to market on the roads the rest of us paid for, you hired workers that the rest of us paid to educate, and that for the greater good, you need to give something back to society. Now, for some people, this feels like a violation of their individual rights. This is my money, and I earned it. From a utilitarian perspective, I think Warren at least makes the case that, look, taking a little bit from you, wealthy person who's been very successful, doesn't hurt you very much. Whereas giving that money to, say, children who need preventative medicine or who need an education so they can go on and have the same kind of success that you have, that makes an enormous difference to them. So if you balance out the harm to the taxpayer versus the good that the taxes can do to give other people more opportunities, that suggests that this is not such a terrible thing. But if you think about it in terms of rights, depending on your gut reactions, you get an impasse that we have a hard time getting past.
You give the example of the difference between Denmark and Greece.
Right. Oh, so this is great. So this is a wonderful set of studies done by Benedict Herman and colleagues. So they use something called the public goods game, which is essentially the problem of cooperation brought into the lab. So in these experiments, everybody, let's say you have four people come into the lab, everybody gets $10, and then you can put that money into a common pool, and then anything that goes into the common pool gets doubled by the experimenters and then distributed equally to all four people. So if you're purely selfish, what you do is you keep your money, because then you keep your $10, plus you get your share of whatever other people put into the pool in order to get doubled. If you're purely us-ish, if what you really do you care about is just the group's well-being overall, then you'll put all of your money in, because that's what maximizes the amount that gets doubled and therefore maximizes the total take of the group. And sort of, well, to describe an experiment that I did as sort of getting to the studies, looking at this around the world, what we found is that, at least in the United States, if you put people under time pressure, they're more likely to contribute. And what this suggests is that we have an automatic setting, a gut reaction that says, be cooperative, contribute to the group. And this is surprising to many people, because a lot of people think, oh, our gut reaction is to be selfish. And then maybe upon reflection, we think, oh, I should be nice, and that's what makes us more cooperative. But our results suggest that at least for a lot of people, a lot of the time, the gut reaction is actually to do the us-ish thing, to be more cooperative. Herman and colleagues took this experiment, this public goods game, and had people play the same game in different cities around the world. And in their version, the experiment was repeated. So you could actually punish people or reward people who you're playing with based on their performance in the last round. So you pay $1, let's say, and you can take $3 away from someone who you didn't like the way they played, if they were uncooperative or whatever it was. And what they found is that with the exact same game, exact same circumstances, same opportunities, people in different cities did very different things. So in Copenhagen and in Boston and in St. Gallen, people put their money in right from the start, and they kept putting their money in, and they walked away with a lot of money. In other places like Seoul, Korea, or Melbourne, Australia, people put in a decent amount at the beginning, and then the people who put in punished the ones who didn't, and as a result, cooperation ramped up, and by the end, it looked like wonderful, cooperative Copenhagen. But in other places, and you mentioned Athens and Riyadh and Muscat, people didn't put in much money at the beginning, and then cooperation never really took off. People and those people didn't end up walking away with a lot of money. And the experimenters were surprised to see something that was going on, which was that this punishment option was there. The thought is that the people who are cooperative are going to punish the people who are uncooperative. But what they found is more often in those places, the people who were uncooperative were punishing the cooperators. They call this antisocial punishment. And they asked them, why would you do this? And they said, you know, I don't like this game here. I don't like this whole idea. I don't know who these people are. And I just want to sort of let everyone know I'm not going in for any of this nonsense. And their interpretation is that it's not that people in Athens, let's say, aren't nice. It's not that they're not cooperative. It's that in that culture, your cooperation, your investment is with people who you know personally, who you have personal relationships with. And the idea of putting your money on the line with some stranger in some experiment just seemed like a very shady thing to do. Or not very shady, but risky and kind of do-gooder-ish. And they said, I don't want to have anything to do with this. And so what this experiment, I think, illustrates is that some places the morality is still quite tribal. That is, people are cooperative, but they're cooperative just with the people that they know and trust based on their personal relationships. Whereas in other places, cooperation, even with strangers, comes quite naturally to people, and they have gut reactions that say, it's okay, we're all in this together, and you know, we can live productive lives by trusting each other.
One of the areas where we see this playing out is in the whole new realm of collaborative consumption and the whole sharing economy that has grown up as a result. And transparency has been the thing that has seemingly made it more possible for us to be willing to trust others.
Right. No, I think that's absolutely right. What makes the global economy run and especially those kinds of commercial transactions where you're really trusting some stranger is a general sense of trust. And in our own experiment, the one that I described where we put people under time pressure and they cooperated more, on average people showed that effect. But if we asked people, to what extent do you trust the people you interact with in your daily life? And the people who said, I don't trust them very much, they didn't show this effect. They didn't have that kind of cooperative intuition. So what's really, as you said, behind this is this sense that you can generally trust people out there to do right by you, even if you don't know them personally, even if they're from a different tribe of historical origin.
Are we seeing any of this change as we become more globally homogenized in some respects?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I think that this is something that's already been changing quite a bit. So there's a wonderful book by my colleague Steven Pinker called The Better Angels of Our Nature, which really traces the historical growth of these more altruistic and cooperative attitudes in the modern world. And you look at the news and you think, oh, the world is going to hell, there's so much violence, but actually it's very surprising to most people, but if you look at the numbers, the world is actually, believe it or not, becoming a more peaceful place. And you see this, for example, in our willingness to help strangers on the other side of the world. So as we know, this terrible tragedy in the Philippines, and you know, many people are donating their money to strangers that they're never going to meet simply because they have the affluence that enables them to help other people. And that's something that historically just would have been completely unheard of. I mean, the idea, not only was it not possible, but even if it were possible, there would be no motivation to do it. Who are these people and why would I want to give up some of my precious resources for them? And, you know, we don't give nearly as much as we could, but the fact that this is something that people even do at all is really quite remarkable from a historical, biological perspective.
Given the experiments you've done, do you find that greater reflection, more time spent in making decisions, sometimes leads to more utilitarian thinking?
Well, in a sense, I think you see this in certain kinds of moral dilemmas. So there's a famous set of moral dilemmas that I and other researchers have used known as the trolley problem. So one version of the trolley problem goes like this. The trolley is headed towards five people, and you can hit a switch that will turn the trolley away from those five people and save them, but it's going to turn it onto a sidetrack where it won't kill one person instead. And if you ask people, is it okay to hit the switch so that instead of five people dying, one person dies, most people say that's okay, and that's a utilitarian judgment. Different case. The trolley is headed towards five people, and this time you're on a footbridge over the tracks in between the oncoming trolley and the five, and you're standing next to this big person, and the only way that you can save the five is to push this big guy off of the footbridge and onto the tracks, and he'll get squashed by the train and die, but the five people will be saved. And so most people there say that that's not okay. And a lot of research done by myself and other people tells us why. So what seems to be going on is we've got that automatic setting, an emotional response that says, ah, don't push the guy off the footbridge. Something about that particular action of pushing the guy, using him as a trolley stopper, makes us say, no, that's wrong. But at the same time, you have the cost-benefit thinking that says, better to save more lives. And what we found, among other things, is that people who are more reflective, so if you give them a tricky math problem where there's an obvious answer that's wrong, and if you think about it, you can get it right, the people who tend to get it right are more likely to say that it's okay to push the guy off the footbridge. You also see this in people who have damage to a part of the brain called the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, which is a kind of hub for emotional signals that bear on decisions. And the people who don't have those emotional signals are more likely to say, okay, five lives for one, that sounds good. So this is a case where being less emotional, not trusting your intuition, being more reflective makes you more utilitarian. Now, I should add, this case was designed essentially to make utilitarianism as a philosophy look bad. And what it's essentially doing is taking a very good gut reaction, which is that it's wrong to harm people in a direct physical way, and pitting it against the greater good. And so I don't think that this is necessarily the kind of case we want to think about when we're trying to figure out what our global moral philosophy should be, but it is an example of what you described in your question. That is a case where being more reflective leads people to favor the greater good, overriding a gut reaction pointing in the other direction.
Are we in some way hardwired to be cooperative?
So what I would say is that we are wired to be, have the capacity to be cooperative, but we also learn from our experience. So we have a suite of emotional capabilities that enable us to cooperate with other people. So we have positive emotions that make us care about other people, empathy. That capacity for empathy, I think, is part of our biological inheritance. And we're capable of feeling guilt, which makes us want to be cooperative. We're capable of feeling gratitude. We're capable of feeling contempt for people who are uncooperative. Those basic emotional capabilities, that's something that you can't learn. You have to have the capacity for those emotional responses. But how exactly those emotional responses are deployed, what exactly triggers our contempt or what triggers our disgust or who we empathize with, that is largely determined by our cultural experiences and our individual experiences. So one way to think about this is like language. Humans, it seems, have an innate capacity for language. You can talk to a chimpanzee all day long and the chimp's not going to talk back to you. But you don't pop out of the womb speaking English or speaking Chinese. You have to actually learn the local language. And so in the same way, we have a capacity to acquire morality that has a biological basis, but the specific morality that you acquire is very much dependent on learning, on your experience.
So it is this balance in many ways. I mean, as we look around the world and try and determine how other people are going to make decisions, there is this complicated balance between biology and culture and really trying to assess the degree of which is most in play.
Yeah. So, I mean, in many cases, I think the biology and the culture work together, but in some important places, I think they don't. So take, for example, so we talked about helping the people in the Philippines who are suffering from the aftermath of this terrible typhoon. My student Jay Musin and I did an experiment inspired by dilemmas posed by philosopher Peter Singer, where we asked people, we said, suppose that you are in this lovely poor country vacationing. You have your cottage up in the mountains overlooking the coast, and in our experiment, sort of sadly coincidentally, we said, there is this typhoon that's hit, and there's devastation along the coast. People are badly in need of food, medicine, and there's sanitation problems. People are getting sick. And the best thing you can do to help is to make a donation to the Red Cross or the Oxfam, who are on the ground helping people. And we asked, well, do you have an obligation to do something to help, to make a donation? And there, in our sample, 68% of people said yes. We gave a different group of people within the same randomized sample similar question. We said, suppose that your friend is vacationing in this country, so on and so forth, and your friend has a smartphone and is showing you everything that's going on. You can see the devastation yourself. You know everything your friend knows, and you can help just as much as your friend by making a donation online. Do you have an obligation to help those people on the other side of the world? And there, only about 30% of people, 34% in our sample, said you have an obligation to help. And so what this contrast illustrates is that we're sensitive to something like distance, just how far away are the victims. And when you reflect on it in manual mode, that doesn't seem like something that ought to matter. You say, well, should I help this person? Well, how many feet away from me are they, right? You don't think that distance by itself really ought to matter. And yet it seems to matter. And so to come back to your question about biology versus culture, from a biological perspective, it makes sense that we should show that contrast. Because morality, basic tribal morality, didn't evolve for us to be nice to everybody in the world. It evolved for us to cooperate with our group, to form a team, essentially, that can outcompete other groups. That's how natural selection works. It's an inherently competitive process. And so it makes sense that we have heartstrings that can be tugged, and it makes sense that those heartstrings can't be tugged very easily from far away. From a biological perspective, again, there's no reason why it would make sense to help people from another tribe, so to speak, on the other side of the world. Nevertheless, as I said, some of us do. Some of us override that biological tendency and say, you know what, someone in the Philippines, their life, their well-being, their suffering is no less important than my own, and I'm willing to sacrifice some of my resources in order to help them. So that's an example of where a kind of cultural moral innovation is overriding a deep biological tendency.
And one wonders the degree to which modernity itself plays a role in that. The very fact that we know inherently today that we are in a world that is more interconnected, and that knowledge alone, what role it plays.
Yeah, no, I think absolutely that, a lot of what brings people together is, knowledge of other cultures, that we can read a story or a novel written by someone in some other country and translate it into our own language, and through, we can share their experience in a way that was not possible before modern technology made these things possible. And global trade, it's often said that trading partners don't go to war with each other, that when societies cooperate with each other, they figure out ways to resolve their differences. I mean, a trading partner is essentially like someone who you play the public goods game with, where you put your money in together and it gets doubled, then it comes out and you both end up better off, and requires trust. But once that trust is in place, that person is now, in a sense, part of your tribe. So the world is getting closer and closer to forming a kind of global meta-tribe. And that's an amazing thing. That's sort of unprecedented in our history, and not something that could ever have evolved biologically, because, as I said, natural selection is a competitive process. If lions are fast and strong, it's because the lions that weren't as fast and weren't as strong didn't survive as well, didn't reproduce as much. And in the same way, if we're cooperative from a biological point of view, it's got to be because that teamwork was a good competitive weapon. But now we have this new idea that the other tribe is not necessarily our enemy, and that we can care about other people simply because they're people, simply because they have the same hopes and fears that we ourselves do. And that's really fundamentally new and biologically unprecedented.
Joshua Green, the book is Moral Tribes, Emotion, Reason, and the Gap Between Us and Them. Joshua, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Appreciate it. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.